You ever think about quitting?
It's the combat of life hammering the snot out of you.
Well, stand by, dig in deep, and get ready to get fired up with us.
Welcome to the Team Never Quit Podcast, the number one podcast that inspires you to fight on. I'm your host, David Rutt Rutherford, here with Mr. Never Quit himself, Marcus Luttrell.
Our mission is to help you embrace the suck of life, to teach you the values of working your ass off, and to interview the most hard-charging people on planet Earth.
We know life is hard. It's time for you to suck it up, Buttercup, and let us teach you to persevere in every environment imaginable by sharing real-world lessons learned by those who never quit. That's right. It's time, Marcus, for us to help them defeat the negative insurgency in their lives.
You fire me up. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's roll.
Let's roll.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Have you ever been there and seen that and heard that?
I've not. Holy cow.
You've been there, dude. You know what?
Right?
That's what they kept telling me last year when I went up for it with the Chris Kyle Foundation. Tay invited me to go up and be part of his pit crew thing. And they just kept saying, wait till you hear the start. Wait till. And I'm like, dude, you know, bro, we were in Coronado, man. I'd go be getting my ass kicked on the beach and there'd be F-15s flying over. You know, I had a daily flyover in the worst.
Whiffy ding.
Yeah, I was like, all right, this is all right. Whatever.
Yeah, super
so we go good. Up, we, this lady, Rita, who's the most wonderful woman in the world. Rita, I love you if you're listening. She's on the Indianapolis Fire Department. She's the AO for that. I mean, she's one. She took me to our seat, like on a 50-yard line for this thing. And it starts, and brother, that was cool, dude. Wasn't it?
Hi.
I mean, it's just cool. I mean, wah, 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 you know, they're revving that. Wah, wah.
Have you ever been to a drag race with the dragsters?
No.
So I got to do that last year. We were up there with the team and the owner of the car. He's like, hey, come with me. And Mojo and I were walking up behind the car.
Yeah.
He's like, no, we're going to get a little closer. And I mean, bro, from me to you, we were standing next to that sucker. When that green light fell and he opened up on that, it's a, you know, one of those. I mean, they'll get your attention fast, yeah, man.
All right. So here's the deal, man. When you think about racing, honest to God, Wizard, when you think about, because I know you like to go fast, bro. All right. When you think about racing, track racing, Baja, whatever, you know, whatever it is, whatever you got that vehicle going at top speed in hazardous conditions, one of the most captivating components of it are the crashes. When people at speed have these horrific crashes, it's one of those things you can't look away from, right? You know how devastating they are. You know how destructive they are.
Well, there's not a pattern to it. You don't know the outcome. When something catastrophic goes down in front of you, and even a lot of events, man, you can anticipate the ending, right?
Right.
When you got something going this fast with this much metal, and TV really doesn't do it justice. You know as well as I do, when you're down on that track, man, they come zipping past you.
Oh,
and they're already
the whole different
back,
world.
Yeah, they're already coming back around one more time.
Oh, bro. And if you watch our guest crash, this thing is just, watch, he comes around here, and whammo, the whole thing catches on fire. The whole front right strut just disintegrates. There's no tire. There's no nothing. And the dude apparently is going some ungodly amount of speed on the
120 miles an hour.
Brother, think about that impact, dude. Because it's not like he like went around and was like, and like, he went, whap.
I know. Well, what's the fastest crash you've ever been in?
Me?
How fast are you going?
Oh, man, that's a good one.
When you actually hit something.
Like, full-blown hit?
Maybe you were going 100, hit the brakes, hit the thing going 25.
I don't know. Every time we jump 30? Out of airplanes, I hit the earth pretty damn fast.
That is a crash.
You know what I mean?
That is a crash.
I crashed, man.
At
least that's what I
There was
meant.
No back.
My teammates always called it that.
It was a crash for you, wasn't it? And that's fast.
Wait a minute. I wanted to ask you, what is the fastest you've been going when you've been in a vehicle accident?
Dude, I don't get in many wrecks, bro. I'm a great driver.
Ever been in one?
I've been in wrecks, but I'm they haven't been consequential wrecks.
Let's just say the average, and I don't know what it is. Let's say the average is you're traveling 45 miles an hour. You hit the brakes before the impact. You actually slow yourself to maybe 20 miles an hour.
Sure.
So what we need to do now to understand this wreck, whatever force that person felt in that accident, the listener at home, think about that accident. Now multiply that by 11.
That's a truckload. Yeah. So when accidents on
I'm
the...
I'm trying to put that in perspective. Because when you watch the video, yeah, it looks really bad, but you still don't understand.
No,
oh,
you
yeah,
can't.
No, yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Definitely there. Not. You know,
yeah, you're right. There's nothing else to measure it off of.
What
you,
I love,
you physically can't get into something like that.
It's one of a kind.
Yeah, exactly.
One of a kind. People. What I love, though, and I flip right over and go to this video with him in his Dancing with the Stars solo intro, is a year later, the dude's competing on Dance with the Star, looking good, looking ripped. He's dancing it up. He gets the pole position at the 2016 Indy 500, the 100-year anniversary, and the guy's kicking ass, man.
Yeah, he crashed in the previous year's Indy, recovers far faster than ever expected, comes back and wins pole position the very next year.
Brother, if that ain't never quit, I don't know what is, man. I mean, that fires me up. And by the way, the dude was impaled. And I hope he talks about that, because I remember going through 18 Delta, and we talked about that stuff, the impalements. And
Somali experiments.
Bro, dude.
But that was like a piece of the suspension, correct? When
it was one of the struts that holds his wheel, his front right wheel in place, detached, went through the frame of his car, and basically shish kebabbed him through his gluteus region.
Yeah, I imagine they'd had to cut that,
yeah, like all
cut
the
that
way
bar in half just all to get him out of the car.
Oh, bro, they were chopping at this whole Santo emergency medical crew. Dude, I got a chance. Last year, I got a chance to talk to the doc that saved his life on the field. Literally, as he was bleeding out, he shoved his fists shoved his fist to tamping off the bleed and saved this dude's life right there. I talked to that guy, brother. And Doc, man, if you're listening to this show, dude, you are a hero, man. Hands down. And he was so humble, so cool, this young dude. He's badass, right? Such a humble dude, man. And he was awesome, dude. He saved his life. Because that got him to the next medic in the rig, and then they got him to the doc, mm-hmm. and then the doc saves his life and all that, man. But, dude.
Golden hour.
Right? Right? So when you think about James Hinchcliffe, and that's our guest today, and if you're this is the first time you're coming to the Team Never Quit podcast, get ready for the ride of your life. Because this show is going to deliver you that you can literally come within into an inch of your death. And if you're determined, fight back to go to the top of your game. It's just a question of whether or not you don't want to quit. And that's what James Hinchcliffe is going to teach you. Man, if you're a regular and you're coming back, God bless you. We love you so much, man. Because without you, we would not have what we have. Right, gents?
Absolutely.
We would not be where we are. And we are so proud, so privileged to have you. All 2.7 million times you've downloaded our show and listened to them to gain the information that's going to help you overcome adversity, you know, just launch over these challenging obstacles of life, to stay in the combat of life and to go racing past the negative insurgency. That's what we do. That's what we do. And if you want to know more, please visit our website at tnqpodcast.com. Follow us on Team Never Quit social media. And if you really want, the best thing I recommend is go to your phone, find us on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and brother, you can get revved up every day you want, morning, noon, or night, whether you're PTing, whether you're at work, or whether you're just driving the family truckster as fast as you can down the highway because you're late to work, you can listen to us. So, that being said, man, Wizard, could you give us a little bit about James Hinchcliffe?
Yeah, let's just hit the facts here real quick, give an overview of who he is, what he's done. So James Hinchcliffe, born in Ontario, Canada.
He's in Canucklin. I love those guys. Hey.
His current race team is Schmidt Peterson Motorsports. That's in the IndyCar series. So this is the IndyCar and Formula One. It's the same thing, right?
No, totally different. Totally different rides. Totally. I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, bro, you just, what, you take your car from here, you go over to Europe, you drive around Monaco, you gamble, you come back. Negative. Have some cheese curds in between the 500 while you're pitting. No, bro, they're different.
Formula One and IndyCars are the same ride.
No. No way.
Formula completely One racing different. Is an IndyCar.
Completely. But then again, I might just be talking. So
there is a difference between F1 cars and IndyCars, as per our resident race pit crew expert.
Ding, 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 ding. Give that man a prize.
One big difference is that F1 cars use high-octane gas.
That's me, high-octane.
No. You are, what did I call you?
You called me a
radioactive scared. Caffeine?
Yeah.
Yeah. IndyCars run ethanol, which is alcohol. IndyCars predominantly race on oval tracks, while the F1 use street circuits.
There you have it. Well, this...
The cars aren't different. The tracks are.
Well, it says here F1 cars have better brakes and stop much faster.
Okay, can we just down to the moron, like the aesthetics? Does it look the same?
It looks pretty damn similar.
I'll give you that.
It looks pretty damn similar.
I'll give you that.
I was confused.
I'll give you that, dude. Right, I'll give you that. Check.
Open front.
Yeah, check. All right, they got the. They're aerodynamic.
Stock about a stock car, all right?
All right, so he's currently racing in the Indy Car Series.
Yes.
He's 30 years old right now. He started into this whole thing, I believe, back when he was 16, 17. That was with karting, Formula BMW Series. And then I guess his first big break, as you call it, he moved into the A1 Grand Prix in 2007. After that, Firestone Indy Lights Series for about a year. And then he gets his big shot 2011 in the IndyCar Series. Starts with Newman Haas Racing and Andretti Motorsport. Finally, with Schmidt Peterson. Then in 2015 is when the big accident happened.
Oh.
We've been talking about this. 2015 during a practice at the Indy 500, coming back to win pole position the following year in 2016. One additional note, totally disrelated, he was on Dancing with the Stars where he won second place with his partner, Shauna Burgess.
Hey, wasn't that the same year that Governor
Rancher.
Perry?
Yeah, Rancher was on there.
Perry, he's on there?
Uh-huh.
Man, that was a good season.
Really? Yeah.
That was a good season. I dig it. Hey, you know what is awesome, and I got to give a shout out to him, is the man that brought him to us, dude. Mr. Jim Leo from Pit Fit in Indianapolis, who is by far one of the most knowledgeable dudes I've ever met in terms of fitness related. And he is the fit trainer of all the top drivers in Indy, man. He is a badass dude, right? Dixon, Hinchcliffe, all Pippa, all these people, they go to Jim, and he's got these awesome things. So I want to just say, first off, you know, Jim, thank you so much for, you know, introducing us to your buddy and for allowing us to get James on the show.
Absolutely, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
What do you say we get this thing revved up and we get old James Hinchcliffe on here?
Do it.
All right, gentlemen, start your engine. All right, Marcus, here's the deal, brother. Here's the deal. I feel like I'm going 200 miles an hour, day in, day out, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even begin to imagine what that would feel like for real. Trust me, I've tried. I could never get a Humvee up that fast, right?
Right, yeah.
Do you feel
the governor,
that?
The governors, right?
The governors they put on them for us, aren't they? Just suck, right? But the idea of speed and the beauty of it, it just, it warms, I'm going to say it again, the cockles of my heart, right?
Yeah.
And so being able to bring this guy on is like the coolest thing in the whole world because I love speed. And I know you love speed.
Oh, yeah. It's addicting. I got to stay away from
it. Wizard, I know you love speed, man.
I'm afraid of speed. No, I'm afraid of myself with speed.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so I think I just want to get at this because I know this guy is going to inspire our audience in ways that's going to take them to Mach 10, brother. Mach 10 today. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the Henchtown Mayor himself. James, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing very well, guys. How about you?
Right. We are above dirt, and that's a glorious thing.
Yeah, right there.
That's about
it. Everything else is good.
That's about it. That's and we got you on here, which is awesome. And so it's even better now. All right.
Well, thanks for having me on.
We're podcasting, and we have, yeah, exactly. I'm sitting here face-to-face talking to you.
One of the best indie drivers there is on the planet.
That's just cool to me. I'm so damn thankful we could do that. Thank you.
Well, I just, again, want to give a shout-out. I did it before to Jim Leo of Pit Fit, man, for hooking this up. I love you, Jim. You are by far one of the coolest mugs I've ever met in my life, and thank you for giving us access to your wonderful friend here. So, all right. So, James, what we have to do is we have to warm up, right? We got to get your engine going, right? The engine right. of your mind. We have to rev it up. Get the RPMs going a little bit. Plus, we're knuckle draggers, so we always have to limber up a little bit. So we're going to get warmed up with something we call the Mad Minute. Now, this is a free fire zone. This is all out. This is pedal to the metal and the most difficult questions that you'll ever face in the history of any interview you've ever done.
All right. I like it. I like right. the challenge.
Good. I know you do. I know you do. So are you prepared for the Mad Minute?
Bring it on.
All right.
Do your worst.
Marcus, fire away, bud.
All right, brother. First car.
It was a Mini Cooper.
Dude, really?
Okay, so there's a bit of a story. There's a bit of an explanation.
It's kind of
weird. Really?
Do I get a chance to explain? Or
yes,
do I just have
no,
to put it
no,
down?
No. We need
By
to hear
means,
this.
You should.
Okay, all right. So here's the deal. All right, so I grew up in Toronto, right? But my dad, he's from England.
Okay.
And when his first car, when he was like 17 years old, was like a 1959 Austin Cooper back then. So the original Mini Cooper.
Very cool.
So when BMW re-released the car in 2003, Dad was kind of going through a midlife crisis, you know, and so he wanted to buy one and kind of bring it back. So he bought this kind of like weekend car for himself, bring it back to his youth or whatever. Couple months later, I got my license and didn't have a car, and so I would always try and borrow a car. And so Dad always had his normal car, so I would start taking the Mini, and I kept buying it. Eventually, I just stopped giving the keys back and inadvertently kind of took it over.
No, that's even better because you pirated his car. I like that.
Remember the movie The Italian Job when that
oh.
right, when Charlize and they were jamming through those that Mini Cooper. Even I wanted to drive one of those.
Well, right, 100%. Here's the best part. The Italian Job was a remake, right? And the original movie with Michael Caine used the original Minis back in the day. And my dad used to show us that all the time as kids. It's one of his favorite movies. So when the new one came out, I mean, before this Italian Job came out, I was already doing that.
You know what? You got the total pass on that story. Yeah. Absolutely. That's actually like the coolest. One of the
when
coolest
he says the Mini Cooper, he's like, wait, there sounds like it had to be the Italian Job. That's the first thing that popped in my head. Because I would have drove the piss out of one too.
That's awesome. Awesome answer. All right, Wizard, fire away.
All right, since we're on the theme of old and then old made new, let's go with who is the better James Bond, Sean Connery or Daniel Craig?
Well, I'm gonna go classic on this one. I'm gonna say Sean Connery.
Ooh, throwback. Because his dad's British, and you know he loves Sean Connery.
Yeah, but
and he drove the Aston Martin. He drove the DB4. You know, like he was the original, right? Like he's the OG. And
he's
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the Daniel Craig movies. It sucks that he like wanted out of the franchise, but then they literally announced like 2 days ago he's back in. That was kind of like, why would you not want to be James Bond? Right?
I don't get it.
They just getting beat up. Hurt, man.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, beat to death, apparently.
Well, you can't do many like drama love movies if you're James Bond.
You're
going
to get your ass beat up.
All right, here we go. If you could go back to any period in history, right, and race some type of mode of transportation in that history, when would it be and what would you race?
So it would probably be like late 70s, early 80s Formula One cars. you know, racing against, you know, my old hero, Gilles Villeneuve, you know, Canadian superstar. Those things, just nothing but raw power. It was before aerodynamics really came into play. So it was mechanical grip and horsepower. And you had to wrestle those things, man. They were beasts to drive. And the old footage watching those guys is just incredible. So I'd love to take a crack at that.
Have you ever gotten to drive one, though, in like one that they've got in a museum or something like that?
No, not yet. I mean, it's very much on the list. You know, that era Formula One cars, and then kind of like the early 90s era Indy cars, right. Similar kind of thing. The Indy cars by that point, aerodynamics were a little bit of a bigger part. But, you know, I live in Indianapolis now, and the Motor Speedway Museum is just down the street from me. And, you know, one of my other racing heroes was Jacques Villeneuve, who won the Indy 500 right. in 1995. And his winning car sits there in the museum. And every time I go there, I point at him like, I will drive you. I'm going to make that happen. So just be ready.
I love it, dude. I love it.
I've been to that museum too, man. Oh, it's really
so
something.
Cool. Yeah. I love it. One of my favorite museums out there, dude.
It is to see the progression of the cars.
Absolutely.
And it'd be interesting, like you said, you want to drive it just to drive it, but the attitude that you have when you get out of it, right? Like what those guys had with pilots, fly by the seat of your pants. Yep. Them dudes were stick and seat and going, oh, man.
Cowboys, man. I mean, those guys were gladiators Ooh. Compared to us. I'll admit that right now.
All right, fire
yeah,
away.
The speed, though. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Okay.
Rabbit hole.
Yeah, sorry. All right, favorite superhero?
Oh, man. Iron Man.
Nice. We don't get many Iron Men on there, James, so I like where you're coming from. And
it's the most realistic, right? I mean, like, you have to get bit by a radioactive spider. That's a tough one to do. You have to come
from
a different planet.
Tell me about it, dude.
Right? I've tried. Trust me. I've tried to find that right radioactive spider to make me cling on walls. It's just hard to do. You know, it's hard to be from Krypton. That's not an easy place to get to. Traffic's a bitch. And so, like, the most realistic one is just become, like, an Uber billionaire and build yourself some badass suit and drive an Audi R8. Sounds like a great life.
Because it is. It's possible.
He's on point.
I know, right? He is on point, man. That's a solid answer. Because you know when you're talking like that in his head, because in mine, I'm in the Iron Man suit, right? And you're like, oh, it's really cool, right?
Totally.
Because the billionaires can totally get that done, right? We need to just
100%
hope around and see
that's
that.
Awesome.
You know, just
Elon Musk could probably build that suit if you gave him enough time.
Oh, you know he's already trying, man. Once he figures out this whole space thing from like up and down real fast, it's on, dude. All right, Wizard, hit him up. He's on a roll.
Okay, I got, if you could no longer be in the IndyCar series, I'm going to give you three alternative choices. One, Circle 8 track racing school buses. Two,
that a shot at us
the
right
European
next.
Truck Racing Championship, which for those who don't know, is road racing semi-trucks. And three, back to the figure eight track again, trailer racing. This is you pull your mobile home behind your pole vehicle of choice. Which...
Man,
what are you most interested in?
So many stellar options to choose from. It's funny because normally when people ask me about what I would do if I wasn't a driver, I'd say I would deliver pizzas really fast.
In a Mini Cooper.
In a Mini Cooper.
Right? Yeah. If they can carry gold through a house, like we can get pizzas through a neighborhood, no problem.
Absolutely.
But that's not an option. So you know what's funny, man? It's because like not a lot of people know about the truck racing. Mm-hmm. And actually one of my sponsors one of those things, and we've been trying to organize like a ride swap where I got to go over to Europe and drive one.
That's cool.
They actually look like pretty cool. It's an insane amount of engineering that goes into making a semi worthy of racing on as like a road circuit. So I think kind of sticking to my roots, I'd probably go with that.
Nice.
I also think you're less likely to like die in a horrible fiery crash than anything on a figure eight track.
You remember the opening scene of Smokey and the Bandit, the snowman's on that track racing his rig. Remember that?
That's like Smokey and the Bandit like 4, though.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it wasn't the first one.
Well, whatever. I digress. It's a lot cooler when it was the first one, I thought.
All right, we'll play the first one. All right. Last question of the Mad Minute. What is the best thing that you do in your life you do slowly?
Oh, man. You know what? So, like, my other big hobby, my other big passion, really, is scuba diving.
Awesome.
And, you know, that because it's the exact opposite of the rest of my life. It's slow pace. It's, you know, you're kind of the outsider. There's no phones. There's no email. There's no one telling you where to go. Mm-hmm. And that you do at a nice, slow, calm pace. So that's probably the big thing that I do slowly.
I love it, man. Cool. That's a great, great answer.
That's true. That's on point, man.
Yeah.
There's nothing fast happens in the water.
For me, it took me like about 10 years, though, to want to actually go scuba diving after I got out, though.
Yeah, 10 years. That's about right.
I didn't want to get near the water for like 10 years, dude.
Fair enough.
All right. Thank you so much, James. That is the Mad 10 Minutes. I appreciate your incredible answers in that. But now let's get serious. Let's shift gears a little bit and get to the meat and potatoes of why people come to the show. We have listeners listening all around the world coming here because they want to hear people that are filled with these incredible stories about how they overcame adversity or jumped across the major obstacles of their life and came back with such resilience and strength like you. So, James, if you could please share with our listeners your greatest never quit story or stories, please.
All right. Well, let's continue on with the car theme. Buckle up. Here we go. In practicing for the Indianapolis 500 back in 2015, my car suffered a mechanical failure. And in the middle of the corner, rather than turning straight, I basically lost all steering and went straight into a wall at 225 miles an hour.
Wow.
We have a little black box in the car, like you would on an airplane, and that told us that when I hit the wall, I hit with 125 G's of force. So, you know, a fighter pilot is about 9 G's, taking off to go into space is about 5 or 6 G's. I hit with 125 G's.
Oh, my God.
And that wasn't even the worst part.
That sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, that alone right there, bad, that man. Just like that just hurt me thinking about it.
Not speed that kills, right? The sudden stops.
Don't get me wrong. Exactly right. Don't get me wrong. That part didn't tickle, but the about it was when I hit a part of the suspension, a metal rod about, you know, bigger than I can show you on this, actually pierced the cockpit of the car and it went straight through my body. Ooh. So I essentially got shish kebabbed. Oh. I was speared by this piece of metal. And when that happened, it actually hit my femoral artery in my left leg. Whoa. And I was very quickly bleeding to death. Through the remarkable work of a lot of different people, but starting with the safety team that travels with IndyCar to all of our races, they're all either firefighters, doctors, EMTs, tons of experience. We're the only racing series on earth that has a dedicated safety crew that comes to all of our events. They managed to, you know, extract me from the car, get the rod out of me, try and stop the bleeding as best they could, got me into an ambulance, started pumping me full of fluid, got me to a hospital. You know, luckily, Indianapolis is the closest racetrack to a level one trauma center that we see all year long.
Wow.
And were you out? Were you out or were you still conscious?
Yeah, good question.
So when I hit the wall, I was massively concussed. So when they got to the car, I was still conscious, but I don't remember it.
Sure.
I was very,
thank
very
God.
Out of it. In the ambulance is when I kind of started going in and out of consciousness as I was, you know, losing a lot of blood. They got me to the hospital. They got me in the OR or the ER first, plugged, you know, needles in each arm to try and start pumping blood into me. But it was coming out almost as fast as it was going in. So they realized whatever the hole was pretty big. Got me straight up into the operating room. In the elevator, the doctor actually lost my pulse. But we got into the operating room. He got me open, found the problem and fixed it. When you talk to him about it, he says 90 seconds to 2 minutes is what we had left before it wouldn't have been able to get you back. So, as I said, I didn't remember any of this part. Last thing I remember, I was driving my race car and everything was just fine. And then in the blink of an eye, I wake up to 6 bright lights in a room full of panicked people. I'm in a neck brace. I'm on a ventilator. I can only talk with pen and a piece of paper. And, you know, they... we make the joke that racing drivers are wired wrong, and the proof's right here, because my third question that I wrote down was, when can I get back in a race car?
That's nuts, by the way. I'm not going to lie to you, James. That's a little crazy.
Yeah, the doctors were a little pissed when I said that, because they're like, all the hard work we just did to save your life, and you want to jump right back in the thing that nearly killed you. I said, Y-E-S, exclamation mark.
Wow.
So, you know, the big thing for me was just, you know, when you wake up in that kind of scenario, you're very disoriented. You know, I'm still concussed probably at that point. And understanding what happened was very difficult. Because the type of injury I had was incredibly rare. We've never heard of a guy get stabbed quite like that by a piece of the car. So I was really having a hard time understanding what they were telling me in terms of what had happened. Most likely it was all going to work out fine. You're going to be able to drive again. And that's all I needed to hear. From that point forward, nothing else mattered but doing what I had to do to get myself healthy and fit to get back into a race car. And, you know, when I woke up that day, they told me that I probably wouldn't walk for about 2 weeks. I probably wouldn't get out of hospital for about a month. And I wouldn't drive a race car for 7 months. I walked on day 4. I got out of the hospital in 10 days, and I drove a race car 4 months later, almost to the day.
Oh, my gosh.
Awesome.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a lot of great people, you know, helping me out, from all the doctors and nurses and everybody that took care of me, my family, once I moved back home. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was that motivation. You know, so again, a switch was flipped in my brain, and it's like, all right, all I need to do now is take that. What I did is I took that competitive energy that you have as an athlete, and rather than having to apply it to some race or some game or some competition, my challenge was, all right, how do I get back as quickly as possible? What do I have to do? Who do I have to listen to? How hard can I push? You know, what do I have? Whatever's in my control, I will control in a way that gets me back in a car as soon as I can.
I love that aspect of competition as a driving force, right? It's, you know, I've been an athlete since I was a kid, and I feel that every day in all that I do. But in terms of being able to redirect a strong point in your professional life into a personal aspect, because healing is so substantial, especially when you're looking at the magnitude of injury you had, the fact that you actually died and came back a couple times. You know, trying to overcome that, did it play a role in any of your mind? Did you ever say, well, maybe I should think about this. Maybe I should take a step back and be like, you know, I got to think about big picture long term. Did that ever enter your mind?
No, not for a second, which is, like I said, why we're wired wrong. You know, it's, I think we're born without that self-preservation gene that most humans have, because, you know, trying to rush back into that scenario seems insane. But my entire life had been dedicated to one thing, which was racing. And the fact that I had even made it to this level, I'm so lucky. You know, I've had so many incredible opportunities that so many people don't get. And even though it got to a point where, you know, it didn't really cost me my life, the fact that I was going to be physically able to do it again, I thought, I can't waste that. You know, there's so many people that tried and didn't get that opportunity. And for them, as much as anything, if I'm still physically able to do it, I want to get back out there and still do it.
I love
great
that.
Great point. It's funny when the doctors, the Hippocratic Oath, man, do no harm. They're great at what they do. And you tell them, like, hey, when can I get back online? Like, well, they can kind of get irritated. I'm like, well, what was the point of saving me then? Because before this, you were happy I was doing this. Everybody's having a great time and all about it. And then you get hurt doing it, and then you get put back together. A lot of people, when they get injured, they come back, they fear that injury. But if you look at it as an athlete, as you're training in every aspect of that, crashing and almost dying is part of that training. Hopefully, most people are afraid of it, so you learn to be good enough to avoid it. But you've been trained to hit the wall, and now you know you can live through it, right? So in your head, you're like, man, all right, I've taken it about as far as I can and survived that one too. Now I know the line. I can push myself. I have the capability of surviving a crash and getting back online and pushing forward. And it's one of those deals when you get hurt, you're starting all the way over in the beginner cycle, but you have the knowledge up in your head.
and your body remembers it. It's an awesome mechanism, right? That muscle memory. So if you you're still beating your mind, your body's not going to progress as fast as it should. And since all you wanted to do is get back on the line, and because you, like I said, the wreck part was blocked out, man. Well, that's even better, and that's why you can go faster, recover faster. Everything falls back into place. And if you're not hurt up here, then your body's not going to be hurt. It heals itself, and it keeps pushing. And the scar is a cool reminder of how far you can freaking go.
What's up? It's true. I mean,
James, you know, did that actually make you a better driver?
You know what? I've said from day one that it didn't change me professionally, in the sense that I'm just as hungry. I'm not more timid. You know, I'll still take the same calculated risks that I did before. It changed me personally in a lot of ways.
How so?
And ultimately for the better. I mean, I've always tried very hard to be one of the people that really appreciates where they're at, you know, in life. I'm very lucky to get to do what I do. Cool. And I've never taken that, you know, for granted. But I think I appreciated the little things a lot more after the fact. You know, the day that I could put my socks on by myself again, like, I was nearly in tears standing in my closet, because for 2.5 months I needed somebody to do that for me. And it's something you do every day and you just take it for granted. It's one of those things, man. When it's your time, and you never know when that's going to come. It could be tomorrow, walking across the street, you get hit by a bus. Things happen, you know, and you really try and live. There's this saying, and I don't know who said it, but it really is how I conduct myself now. It's live each day as if it's your last, because one day you'll be right.
Amen to that. That's for sure.
There you go.
One of the things that we always like to talk about, and you referenced it a couple of times here, whether it was, you know, the emergency crew that saved your life on the track, whether it was your actual crew that gets your car ready every day, or it's your family at home putting your socks on. How important are the teams around you in your life, and in terms of fulfilling that gratitude? Do you lean on them extensively? How do you work those relationships so they continue to flourish and be nurtured in really kind of a pretty extreme lifestyle that you live?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you've got to surround yourself with a very specific kind of person, you know, to kind of get through what we do. And, you know, luckily, from the medical and the safety side, I mean, those people are provided for us in the IndyCar world. And, you know, that the level of comfort you have knowing that quality and that caliber of person is going to be there if something does go wrong, it does make you sleep better at night. And then, you know, seeing how certain friends and certain family members, you know, rallied around what happened. And everybody kind of had the same attitude that I almost did. It's like, all right, this has happened. There's nothing we can do about that now. What do we need to do to get it better, to get back to where we're going? And seeing how people react and behave in those kind of situations, you know, I think it really bonds people and brings them together. And, you know, you'd like to think that if the situation was reversed and they needed someone in the same capacity, you know, that you would be able to just drop it all and do exactly what you had to do and play your part to get them back to where they needed to be. And I think it's just a nice comforting place to be in. And some of those relationships have definitely grown stronger as a result.
Awesome, man. I love that answer, dude. I love it.
I have a question. It might seem a little bit delayed or out of order here, but I know it's important for our listeners to kind of have a picture of, to put themselves and understand how significant your injury was and what it was like to hit the wall at that speed and all that. And I'm wondering if you can just kind of give us an idea of what it's like being out there on the track, what it's like being a driver out there on the course, as well as the team, kind of the team that surrounds you, because this is what the pinnacle of technology as far as motorsports goes, is from what I understand. And I know your team has a lot of technical support around you, but can you kind of give us an idea of what it's like to be out there on the track?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll address the second part first, actually, because when people think about racing, they think of it very much as an individual sport. You know, they think of it like golf or like tennis, where it's one person, you know, and it's they're mainly in control. And that's actually a little misleading, because it takes about 20 people for me to get my IndyCar on a racetrack and fire it up and go racing.
Wow.
From the people that help manufacture and assemble it back at the factory, then the truck drivers that bring it to the racetrack, to the mechanics that set it up and manage it there, the engineers that give them all the guys over the wall doing the pit stops. One person doesn't do their job right, we're in an incredibly competitive environment. There's 20 other guys out there that are going to pounce on that mistake, and you're not going to win if the whole team isn't operating at 10 tenths. And you know, you take it even a step further, I'm literally strapping myself into a 220-mile-an-hour rocket ship that a bunch of other people have put together.
Exactly. Uh-huh. That's what I'm wondering about.
You know, you've got to trust the guys that you're working with because my life's in their hands.
I love that aspect of it. I mean,
so it is in a lot of ways like the epitome of a team sport. So it is very technologically advanced, as you said. I mean, the cars have 100 sensors on them that are constantly beaming data back. Engineers are going through it. It's incredibly labor intensive in that sense. But the feeling of being on the racetrack is a tough one to really explain, because the other misleading thing that people think about racing, on top of it being an individual sport, is that drivers aren't athletes, because they can only compare it to driving a road car, which, yes, is not physically very challenging. Anybody can grab a basketball, stand at a three-point line, miss 9 out of 10 shots, and say, hey, Steph Curry's really good at his job, right? But so few people get the opportunity to try and actually drive a car at its limit to know how challenging it is. It's mentally incredibly challenging to find that limit. And then when you get into this level of the sport, the physicality is huge. Our cars don't have power steering, right? And because we generate downforce, the faster we go, the heavier that steering gets. So we essentially have two airplane wings on the car that are flipped upside down. So the faster we go, the car doesn't lift up, it gets squashed into the ground. So we'll corner at, say, 3G. So a 1,500-pound race car is now cornering, it weighs 4,500 pounds. You don't have power steering. So you're wrestling that thing around that corner. For the sake of argument, let's say your head weighs 10 pounds. You're going through that corner. Well, now your neck's got to hold up 30 pounds. Your legs are unsupported. And so you're very delicately balancing the pedals, gas, and brakes. So you have to be able to support your legs with your core and your leg strength. And that's all those muscles are working simultaneously for one corner of one lap. We could have a track that's got 15 corners and do it for 90 laps. So you're working very hard over that lap. Your heart rate gets up. And we're not like hockey, where it's, you know, flat out for a 2-minute shift and then you sit on the bench for a bit. It's not football, where it's explosive for, you know, 10, 15 seconds and you regroup. Mm-hmm. We're out there doing that for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, depending on the length of the race. So your cardio needs to be like marathon status. So we have to go 6 days a week to make sure we're fit enough to race these things at the absolute limit. So when you're out there, you're fighting all these G-forces, you're flying around the racetrack at 200 plus miles an hour. Basically, the best way to describe it, Wizard, to a layman or someone who hasn't done it, it's like flying a fighter jet around a gymnasium.
I love that.
Can you actually do that? No, I get it.
I love it.
That really puts it in perspective.
It does. That's an awesome description.
Basically, one of the things you get out of and it comes down to, you're not there racing them other boys in those cars. You're racing that car. You're seeing who can handle that car the best.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. It's a huge thing about the compatibility between man and machine. You know, and how do you get the most out of yours? How do you connect with yours the best? And for sure, but the thing is, it is kind of like golf in the sense that you're not against one opponent, right? So like if you play football or basketball or tennis, you either win or you lose, right? There's no other way around it. In racing, you can come second, third, fourth. You've got to beat everybody every weekend. It's like every single weekend is the Super Bowl or the World Series, because you've got to beat all the teams in the entire every single week.
That's cool. I like that. I like that aspect of it. It's one of the coolest things there. I want to take a step back a little bit for you. And you said at the beginning of the interview, this is the only thing you've ever wanted to do. I mean, since the time you were a kid, can you describe the hurdles and just the drive and how you knew, right? How you knew this was it and this is what you want to do and there was nothing that was going to get in your way to get there. Can you describe a little bit of that for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out if it's what I really want to do. Well, I'll let you know.
Well, that's what you want to do right now.
Yeah, it's working for right now.
But he got excited about those other options I gave him.
I've been really thinking about that figure eight racing. No, it's a very difficult sport to break into because it is so expensive to do it. There are so many barriers to entry in motorsports. It's not fair. It's actually a terrible sport as the guy in it. It's great to watch. It's super entertaining. But it is so tough, you know. Like if you're insanely good at basketball, you could play high school basketball for some no name school in some podunk town somewhere. But someone's going to hear about it, and through social media or the internet somehow, someone's going to find you, and you will end up going to a good college, and you will end up playing pro ball if you're that good. Mm. For all we know, the best racing driver that's ever lived maybe never even got to race a car. Because getting to do it, even at the most basic level of go-karting, can be incredibly expensive. So the hurdles that every driver's had in his career or her career is the sponsorship element of it. You know, a very famous racing driver, Jackie Stewart, three-time F1 champion, said, you know, you've got to be 80% businessman, 20 to go racing. You could be the best guy ever, and no one's going to know about it. So as a young kid coming up, you are constantly facing adversity and trying to find those sponsor dollars. You're constantly getting told no, trying to sell these companies on, you know, giving you money to go racing is a very, very tough thing to do. And, you know, I started sitting in at boardrooms when I was 17 years old, trying to essentially sell myself as an ambassador and try and sell my sport as a marketing vehicle for these companies. And like I said, there's a lot of rejection to that. You know, there's a lot of times where I thought my career was over because we just ran out of cash. There just wasn't the money to do it.
Wow.
And a lot of guys kind of meet that fate in their racing career. But it's like anything. You know, there's no substitute for hard work. There's no substitute for persistence. And the ones that keep pushing and keep working hard and maximize those opportunities when they come up, those are the ones that ultimately, you know, make it. And like I said, there were times where I thought it was all done, and then some saving grace would come, door would close, window open, whatever analogy you want to use. And every time I was put in that situation, I just did everything I could to maximize that opportunity and try and prove that I belonged to be there.
I love how he talks about the maximizing opportunity, right? We've had a lot of guests come on and say, because of the hard work, the determination, chasing the dream, the greater sense of purpose, you know, you create opportunities for you. But it is capitalizing in the moment when the stress is highest, when, you know, if you don't do it this time, it could be all over. Have you found that that you thrive in that space? And if you do, what are some examples that can teach that to other people?
Well, so one of the stories that I kind of like telling about, you know, my career and coming up is, understandably, my parents looked at me when I was young and said, I want to, you know, be a race car driver. And they said, well, that's not the most secure, guaranteed career choice. So we're going to keep you in school until as late as possible. I said, fair enough. So like all through school, I had to maintain an 80 average or else my car got taken away. And I did what a lot of drivers don't do. By the time you're ready to go off to college, you're usually pretty involved in your racing career. And so most drivers don't even attempt college. I did. I didn't have a professional gig yet. And so my parents were like, hey, you're not making money driving. You got to go to school. So I went to university, and about a year and a half into my time in college, I got an offer from a team. It was kind of one below the IndyCar level. They were associated with an IndyCar team, fully paid sponsor, like a dream opportunity. This kind of opportunity that you just can't, you know, you can't miss, and it doesn't come up again. And I wanted to maximize it. I didn't want to be wasting energy on trying to keep my grades up in school and missing out on this opportunity. So I went to my parents and I said, hey, look, I've got this opportunity. I want to put school on hold and see how this works. If I'm going to do this, I want to commit myself 100% to it. So they said, all right, go to your school, see what kind of deal you can work out, and let us know. So I went to the school, explained the situation. They said, no problem. Come back anytime in the next 5 years and pick up where you left off. So I go to mom and dad. I said, here's the deal. They're like, cool. You've got 5 years to make a living driving cars, or you're going back to school. So fast forward. So I'm sitting here as a cocky 19-year-old being like, no problem. We'll be professional in a year and making money. It'll be great. Apparently, plans don't go exactly like that. And, you know, 2008 hit, which hurt everybody. And the first thing to go in companies' expenses is frivolous things like motorsports programs.
Race cars.
Exactly. And so the whole racing world took a huge hit right when I was about to make my jump pro. So, you know, so fast forward 4 years and 4.5 years. And I've been racing the level one below IndyCar, Indy Lights, had a really good season, finished second in the championship, closest margin to the champion in history. And an IndyCar team calls me up and they say, hey, we like you, we like what you've done, we want to give you a test. So this is one of those opportunities we talk about. This is everything right. that I've done is to get a call from an IndyCar team and a chance to get in one of those cars and prove what I can do. So I prepare as best I can. We go to this test. This team has already hired one driver, a 10-year veteran, and they want a rookie driver to be his teammate and kind of have the, you know, the old and young kind of setup. So we go to this test in Florida, and at the end of the test, I was a tenth of a second faster than my teammate, who was a 10-year veteran,
wow.
first time in the car. And I'm like, I walked away from that moment. So I guess to answer one of your questions, awesome. I sort of thrived in that one. You know, I had this opportunity that really was for me a make or break career moment. And I did everything that I had to do and nailed it.
Pretty cool feeling when it comes all together at that moment, right?
Most 100%.
Of the moment jumps in front of you and you go at it, and you know, when you hit the water for whatever reason, you don't perform like you thought you should have. I can get to you, man. But when it all comes together at the moment it was supposed to, that's kind of a there's a yeah. feeling.
Unlike yeah. anything else.
Yeah.
No feeling like it, you know. And I walked away from that moment thinking I've done it. Like I, for the last 15 years, I've worked towards essentially this goal, and I just got that opportunity and nailed it. And the team sat me down the next week, and they're like, look, incredible job. We love you. We're going to sign you. I said, awesome. I'm an IndyCar driver. But then they said, we don't have any money, though.
Uh-huh.
I was like, all right. We can fix it.
You didn't say you wanted to be a paid IndyCar driver, okay?
No. Worse than that. Not even just they didn't have enough money to pay me. They didn't have enough money to run the car.
Oh, my gosh.
So we didn't have a sponsor to go racing. So I'm like, all right, but we got a couple months. We'll figure this out. Long story short, the drop-dead date to get a car on the truck to go down to the first race in Florida came and went, and we didn't have a sponsor. And I went down to the race as a member of the team without a car, absolutely devastated. And I sat there watching all the cars drive around, and I thought to myself, you know what? It's been 4.5 years. Come September, my 5 years is up, and I've got to go back to school. This is in April.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? What's meant to be is meant to be. Clearly, this wasn't it. I did everything that I could do in my power, everything I could physically do to put myself in the right position to get the opportunity, to maximize the opportunity, and it didn't all come together. I guess that's life. I'm not the first guy in the history of motorsports that has that story. I'll enjoy the summer, travel around with the team, have one kind of last hurrah, and then I'm going to be back to the books come September. And I had to like almost kind of accept that. And 24 hours later, a company called back and said, yeah, we're in. When's the next race? And I made my IndyCar debut the next race.
Awesome story.
Very cool.
Awesome. I love that.
I was like 4 months away from going back to school.
The whole concept of, and just so many people hit that moment where it's just like, man, I'm not it. But you always hear the stories like yours or other people that come on. Well, I just stuck it out for a couple more weeks or just 6 more months and it all happened. That's the never quit mindset.
You know what happens when you stick never it out quit. That extra is you actually go through the emotions of the good and the bad part of it. Not getting your ride, not having money, and those peaks and valleys, right?
Yep.
But just stay in the course, just that straight line, just to see what let's just see what happens, man. Let's just play this out. There's always more time than you think. That's
a beautiful statement.
And when they
right
say
there.
Drop dead time, man, we're not there yet. Yeah, mm-hmm. Man, we're getting close. Well, close is not there yet, kind of deal.
Yep.
And so you get that emotional ride and the knowledge that comes with it, right? You appreciate the fact that I didn't have one, but now I do. When they're that close together, why it makes you appreciate all of it in its entirety, right?
Infinitely
it's not suffering in one or celebrating in another.
Oh, yeah.
You see these examples of guys where their story was a little more straightforward. Either they had somebody that backed them from a young age, or their families were wealthy enough to get it all done, or they just were in the right place at the right time and always landed that sponsor and never kind of faced that adversity. And they get to that top level and they think that it's just owed to them to be there. Do you know what I mean? Like, they've almost got this sense of entitlement. I hate to say it like that, but that's almost what it's like. And those guys, once you get to the top level and you're up against all these other guys that have been through so much to get there, they get buried, man. When you're up against the younger guys that are still coming up or whatever, you can race against them. You can have that attitude. That's fine. But when you get to the pros at this level, the sheer grit and determination of the guys that had to fight tooth and nail to get there wins 9 times out of 10 over the kid that just got there kind of too easily.
I love that.
Oh, man.
When
your reputation far exceeds your talent, you're going to be in trouble, especially when you step into the deep end of the pool. And that is the bad part about it. To their credit, though, when, you know, that's all they hear. Like, hey, this is, you know, this is your ride. You're taking this. You have to tell them that, right? I would imagine, especially the lineage in y'all's sport is pretty heavy, too, right?
For sure.
Legacies down the board. They see granddaddy, great grandfather, father, what they do, man. You know, them guys are winners. You're talking about alphas here, man. They're not going to say that you're not going to earn your stripes. I mean, you're going to be the best. You know, it's all. But if you keep telling them that without putting them out there and letting them prove it, you know, the baseline, right?
Yes.
Building it together. Yeah. You got to have, I mean, one of those can't go ahead of the other. Otherwise, you're.
Well, I think every guest we've
you in
had,
trouble.
Every
can't
guest,
have an imbalance.
It doesn't exist, right?
For sure.
They get crushed mentally and on the track.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a lot of examples of guys that had the talent, but you're right. They didn't have that counsel. They didn't have that person that was keeping them in check on the way up. And they get beat mentally more than they do even on talent.
Yeah. I love it.
Mine's holding him back.
Yeah. Well, James, before we wrap it up here, I want to just ask you one more thing or a couple more things. One in particular for our listeners. There are a lot of people out there right now that, you know, are listening to your story and like, my gosh, the guy had been, you know, committed since young age. He almost died. He's back in the car. He's still pushing hard. What does James do every day? What does he say to himself every single day that to get back in that vehicle, to push harder the next day, to elevate his game, to live in that never quit space? So what are some things that you utilize and tap into every single day to maintain?
You know, it's funny. I pull back and draw from that feeling that I had standing there at that first race without a car, almost accepting that it was over and realizing that that's how hard I had to work to get here, you know. And I wake up every day getting to say I'm an IndyCar driver. All I ever wanted to do and all I worked for 15, 20 years trying to make happen. And so, you know, you wake every day, you know, like you say, you're above the ground and I get to say this is what I do. I draw off that feeling, you know, and it's almost a bad way to say it, but it's almost living in fear that it's going to get taken away.
Oh, you know, no, it's totally that. I love that.
That's what pushes you. That's what motivates you. You know, it's like you don't, and I almost knew what that was like before it even started. And then I almost knew what that was like again when I got hurt, because there was that brief period where I didn't know. Like, I woke up looking at hospital lights with a tube down my throat. I didn't know if I was ever going to sit in a race car again. And I've been in enough moments where I almost lost it, you know. And you want to motivate somebody, take something they've worked their entire life trying to get away from them.
I love that. That's profound, brother. Well, James, man, it is just your outlook and your mindset is exactly what our show is all about. And we just can't thank you enough for coming on, sharing your story. Where can our listeners find you and follow you and start rooting for you and just be a part of the Hengetown, man? Can you share them with that?
I mean, Hengetown's the place to go. You know, it's at Hengetown on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, Hengetown.com. You know, it's my mythical, magical little city that I'm the self-proclaimed mayor of.
I love being a member of Hengetown. Love it.
New residents, moving in.
There you go. No speed limits. It's a great place to be.
I love it. Well, sir, thank you so much, and we'll be rooting and cheering for you, and I can't wait to see you again sometime on a track in the future, brother. God bless.
Absolutely. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, guys. Real privilege. Thanks for letting me on. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it was on this end. Believe me.
Great to talk to you.
We'll be rooting for you now, brother.
Amen.
Take care.
Thanks,
guys. Take care, James. First off, anybody that just wants to go that fast on a regular basis, you're right. They're not wired right. And who is, right? Especially in our world, but that's another issue. Dude, I had a friend who let me go up. He owned two MiGs, took me up one. We pulled like for 5 seconds, 12G. It was like this crazy barrel loop thing he did. Almost blacked out, was like, you push force all that blood down here,
yeah,
you know, and you're
like, maneuver.
And I was, but when we landed on the ground, dude, I was a mess for like hours, dude.
That's like exactly. You know, they're all those pilots, man. They are cool, bro. Because when they jump out, throw those aviators on there in their flight suit, and they're good.
Yeah,
their body's used to that.
But I was green, like gonna vomit out on myself.
Exactly. hung over and felt like I've been, whipped and worked out for 3 days. That kind of deal. And I think I passed out in that Williams turn.
Right.
And he was, he's messing with me, and I'm like, I'm in here. And when you first go in, they're teaching you how to do the Hick maneuver. He's like, hey, you need to tighten up your thing. He's kind of, it looks ridiculous. You're like, I ain't doing that. I'm too cool, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Buddy.
You're doing it.
Oh, my God.
Well, I think another component that was really cool about him, too, was the fitness levels, right, Wizard? I mean, when you think about that, that's remarkable. I mean, the amount of time and the effort and the that was what
I thought that was really interesting. The stamina and endurance.
Well,
required,
he was talking about how they don't think that racing
going
is
like that.
Yeah, racing.
Yeah, you
is
wouldn't
a sport.
Naturally. And that's kind of why I asked that question to get more of an idea, because a lot of people out there aren't going to have any reference for what he does other than a movie.
Sure. What are the movies?
I think that's really interesting. It's just kind of shot at them. I mean, they are athletes, right?
What was the Sylvester Stallone movie? What was it called? Fire Crack Up? What? No.
Driven.
Driven, dude.
Driven.
I liked it.
That was good. He flips that dime on the track. Wait a second. Totally out of space. I wanted to say that you got the physical aspect of it, but the focus and the mental element.
Crazy.
That you have to combine that with. Over what is the length?
Four,
I mean, obviously 500
hours.
Laps, and it'd be 500. But what is the time of that race? General
4 hours.
General length.
Yeah, 4 is one of the longest.
That's a long time to maintain that.
Bro, at that speed,
that razor's edge level of focus, because that's really what those guys are pushing. They're pushing their equipment as close to that line as they can.
Absolutely.
I was under the impression that car, because it looks so sleek and sexy, and the way it drives and hugs a track, that thing was. You're racing the other guys.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the cars. Yeah. They built this car and it's red. I didn't know he's out there fighting that damn car.
That was what blew me away, too.
You can drive that, just wrestle that car into gear and get it through there. And they are athletes, man. Like we were talking about when they say that the drivers aren't athletes, that's just people poking shots at them, I think, man. Because anybody who's actually been down there and seen those jokers have to deal with that.
Bro, dude. That's why my buddy Jim, dude, he swears by these guys. I mean, he crushes them, and they push themselves harder and harder and harder.
You've been out there, Indy, right?
Last year.
Something related to a pit crew.
No,
right?
I was so blessed. Taya Kyle invited me to be a part of the Chris Kyle Foundation. We had this wonderful pit crew that she brought together, first responders, a bunch of vets, got together, and we were a pit crew, and we were actually competing in the pit crew competition, and I got some exposure to what the Indy thing is, man. And the other thing is just like, what do you say? 100 data points feeding data, your pit crew, putting wheels on and off. 'Cause every second is critical, right? I mean, it's a game of a hundredths of seconds, and to have all of this functioning at one time with this incredible athlete in the car. And mind you, 19 or 20 other dudes going 200 miles an hour around you. It's one of the coolest sports out there, bro. Yeah. I think.
Well, it boils down to it's Yeah, the driver, he's in there to, and that's what you see, but it's literally all of those 20 people competing at the, against the other 20, right?
It's, right.
You, all of them guys have to be the pros.
Yeah.
Right? They're all pros.
Right.
And the other part that I thought was so interesting was, and he mentioned it, talking about he's got this team that's responsible for all these components that are surround making this car do a race, stay out there on the track and be safe. And how much faith he has to put in all those people to have done their job correctly because it's his ass.
Well, what if Bob, you know, your ratchet guy, goes out the night before big race, gets hammered, right? You know, misses muster, comes in late, he's dogging it, you know, he hasn't had his B12 shot, and, you know,
got distracted by his Instagram feed and just didn't hit the torque spec.
Yeah, he's doing the selfie while he's wrenching on the car, and he misses the torque spec. Night. It's crazy, dude. I mean,
that's what I mean. That's an incredible amount of faith.
It's huge faith. And on top of that, I just keep going back. And if you're listening, you want to go watch that crash on YouTube. And it's you shake your head going, my God, how is the man not disintegrated, right? Now,
kind of
knowing,
like Dana Bowman hitting in the air. Just remember watching him.
That ran into each other in the free fall jump. Oh,
when they were tracking down. I don't know if they were in a diamond or what they were doing, man. And when they collide, it just looks like a big explode, like a watermelon kind of blows up, right? And then one dude tumbles over to the side. And it's all on video.
Oh, my God.
And you're just like, how can anybody come through that?
Right. And he did.
I mean, got some hardware. And same thing with this. Hitting that wall that hard, man, and just
being impaled like that.
It's that human spirit, right? You can break everything around it.
But you can't break it.
You can only do that mentally. You can only give up on yourself, right? And I think the minute you kind of do that, like if you're like, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it through this, then I think that energy kind of goes down because you can fire yourself up and you feel it get bigger. Hmm. If you let that battery get too low when your body's in that state, you'll die.
Absolutely.
Right. But if you're just kind of hanging in there, man, like one more second and give your body time to heal, because it wants to heal. It's the most
fuel back up.
Man. And that kind of your soul and your spirit is what tells your body that it's going to be all right. And then your body just lays there and starts to heal. And then you see that, you're like, all right, man, I'm back online, right? And you start pushing forward. But I think if you give up on yourself, man, I mean, hell, what's the point, right? I mean, can't anybody else help you? They can do all they want. But if you've already given up, man, and your body knows, like if you know that yourself, I think you're cutting yourself short because the body doesn't know when it's time to die. It doesn't.
Oh, man, I love that.
Your mind has to tell it that.
I love that. I think
interesting.
That's beyond cool, man. That's perspective right there. So if you're listening right now and you're banged up, you're struggling through something, you've got an injury, you're banged up emotionally, mentally, man, your body's not dead, right? Your mind's not dead. Your heart's not dead. Get back in the fight. Don't quit. That's what this show's about. And that's what James' story today was. He's so passionate. He's so driven to realize his purpose and his dream of being one of the top drivers in the world that he was able to be in one of the most horrific accidents ever and still get back in that car 4 months later. So the message is you're not completely broken. You're banged up, but you got to get back in the fight. That's the never quit mentality. All right, we've got a reader story today that I think embodies that kind of thing. And so if you gents don't mind.
We do.
I'm going to read this one for us. Here we go. My name is Jay. I'm from Alabama and I'm 18 years old. Before I say anything, I would like to thank you guys at the TNQ podcast for your service and everything you've done for this great country. But I love and appreciate the fact that you guys are still serving people by discussing and breaking down what it takes to have that never quit mindset. In September of 2015, I was sitting in a healthcare class at my local tech school. My teacher was demonstrating how to use a stethoscope. Man, I've been a doc, a medic for 20 years. I still can't say that word. I'm sorry.
You got sphygmomanometer down yet?
No.
I'm going to butcher that one to death.
I don't even bother trying on that one.
Why name that? You know, that's just doctors showing that. Yeah.
That's
big words, man. That sounds smart.
That's because they hate us. They hate the knuckle dragon. All right. Sorry about that, Jay. In September 2015, I was sitting in a healthcare class at my local tech school. My teacher was demonstrating how to use a stethoscope. Out of the 30 students in the class, and though through the miracle of Lord above, my teacher picked me to demonstrate how to listen to a patient's heart rate. My teacher had a weird look on her face, like something was wrong. My teacher began to inform me that she heard some irregular rhythms and skip beats. So she suggested I go see a cardiologist. With both of my grandmothers having a history of aortic aneurysms and massive heart attacks, I guessed it would probably be a good idea that I see a cardiologist. My doctor said my heart was good for now, but did notice on the chest x-ray that there was something abnormal. He said my chest was caved in and that I have pectus evacuatum, which is a connective tissue disorder where the sternum grows inwards and sinks in the chest wall. I've always been aware my chest looked like Superman punched me. My cardio doctor referred me to a surgeon that specializes in the condition. And though many lung tests, EKGs, and other tests, my Superman hole was about 4 inches deep and was restricting my lung capacity and heart function. My lungs had only been acting at 60% my whole life, and my heart compressed into a little corner of my chest cavity. So now I had the answer of why I was so dog tired and sweating like crazy just after the first 20 minutes of football practice. I was sitting in a room with my mom waiting to meet the surgeon, who entered and placed a laptop on the table of her during the surgery of some kind. She said it hurts like hell and then left the room. I'm watching this kid flip all over the operating table as she moves this curved metal bar under his chest and then rotating the bar to pop his chest back out. I said, yep, sign me up. Whatever it takes to breathe normal. I found myself getting a metal bar shoved in my chest in May of 2016. A week in the ICU. 6 different pain medications. 6 months of recovery. 2 months bedridden, 2 months of my parents having to move my big ass in and out of bed. My parents showered me and practically everything else except fed me. But when I woke up from surgery, I took the first deep breath of my life, kind of a similar to the episode with Justin Legg. Every day I had to make myself not quit, keep my goal in my mind to make it back for basketball season. 2 months later, I was progressing and getting ready to start my first day of physical therapy, but I had a knot come up on my side where the metal bar in my chest had slipped out of place, and I find myself in pre-op room the next day to start the whole process over again. Wow. Everything I had worked for right in front of me, but all summer, I would watch Marcus's speeches on YouTube. Sitting in the pre-op room, I told myself what Marcus said. He told himself during the op, quit being a bitch and get up. Some things went south during the surgery. When removing the old metal bar, the bar punctured my lung and chest wall slammed back down into its old position and knocked my heart rate down to a critically low rate. Long story short, I eventually fought my way back by applying the never quit mindset to tackle the pain and turn it into a positive. I played my senior basketball with my new chest and I could play all game long with that new breathing. So, still to this day, I meet teens at my local county that have the same condition as I did. Every person I tell my story to, I describe the never quit attitude and the TNQ community. I want to spread my story not to receive any pity or applause, but to help people with my condition and inform them that there is a solution. Thank you, and God bless you guys. Jay, that's awesome, man.
Yeah. that's tough, man. That
job, Jay.
Having that, we got a couple buddies. There's some guys in teams, yeah. And yeah, we know a couple guys that had that.
Whew.
Have you ever had anything like a pin or where they had to do something with the bone and snap it back or pull out?
But knock on wood.
Man, there is a feeling like when you're talking about when it comes, something comes out of you and you have to get in there and start popping stuff like that, man, it is to the bone. That's to the bone, right?
Right.
And
I felt that when he described that bar inverting again. That was.
Oh, man. I just love it. I love, Jay, that you faced that and you got a positive attitude. You didn't quit and you kept coming back for more. But what I love most is your willingness to share the story to help others.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're here to do. That's what you're doing. That's what the whole TNQ podcast community is about. So if you're listening to Jay's story, if you're listening to James' story, if you've listened to our stories, please don't be afraid. Write into us. Go to our website at TNQ Podcast and submit your never quit story so we can use it. Read it on here if it's awesome. And if it's really great, Marcus,
bring him on.
Bring you on to help other people discover the never quit mindset in themselves. What a great show, man. I feel so blessed today. James was awesome. I just want to start out and again give thanks to God and Christ, my girls. Thank my parents, my family, my close friends. Thank Jim Leo again for bringing James. I want to thank James. I want to thank Jay for writing in. Thank the two of you. Man, because I what we're doing, man, we're helping people in the biggest way. And I'm just so blessed and thankful.
It was, man. I enjoyed that. It's the craziest thing, man, because we're getting fired up and find some of that. I guess that sick enjoyment, listening to that dude talk about how he got jacked up, right? He's like, then the bar went through my... I was like, oh, that was awesome, man. I bet that shit hurt. God, no, man. But it's true, right, man? And it's in those worst scenarios and situations, especially when the person comes out and tell you about it, and they keep pushing forward afterwards. It just gives you that reassurance, man, that... Hell, I thought I had it bad. And then you find hear something like that, and he pushed it further and made it out of there. So don't give up on yourself, because once you do that, man, I mean, it's all over. So thank you guys for coming on here and keep coming back and keep having us back and letting us do this. This is the coolest job in the world, man. I ain't even gonna lie. Just getting to hear these stories and watch the expressions on their face, right, when they're telling, because you know they're dug in. Some of them, man, they get to you deep. It's one hell of a ride, guys. Thank y'all for doing it. I'm out.
I'm out.
Never quit radio.